Up next, we're going to be talking with a psychiatrist about the paranormal, truly a remarkable story. Manny Mates' book is called The Borders of Normal, and just get ready for this, folks. It's going to be an amazing ride, and then we'll take calls next hour with him on Coast to Coast AM. Let me tell you a bit about Dr. Manny Mates. He has 40 years of experience working in the mental health field, a medical degree from the University of Manitoba, his diploma in psychiatry from McGill University. Now, throughout his entire life, he has had many close brushes with death as well, starting in the womb. Yeah, he's had a number of paranormal or anomalous experiences, visions, precognitive dreams, out-of-body experiences, encounters with message-bearing apparitions as well. Welcome to the program, Dr. Manny Mates on Coast to Coast. Doctor, welcome to the show. I'm looking forward to this.
Thanks for inviting me.
Very interesting that somebody with your medical and psychiatric background would be so heavily involved in the paranormal. And how did that all happen for you? Was it the near-death experiences that started it?
Well, I think it was because I almost died so many times. You know, when my book, The Borders of Normal, first came out, many people asked me if the book was based on stories which my patients had told me. But my answer was always no, not at all, because whatever a patient tells a doctor is confidential. A doctor is bound by the Hippocratic Oath, which states that a doctor should not repeat anything he's told by his patients, and I don't. So the material in my book was based entirely on my own personal experiences, plus stories from my readers and from my audiences and from family and friends and from my own extensive reading and research into the paranormal. In terms of why I had these experiences, I think it is related to the fact that I had so many close calls with death, so many brushes with death. You know, there's been a lot of literature written about the near-death experience.
Mm-hmm.
But the term near-death experience, you know, was coined by Dr. Raymond Moody in 1975, so that's over 40 years ago.
That's right.
Now, I think he estimated that something like 1 in 30 Americans has either had a near-death experience or know someone who has had one, and that's a large group of people. But there's an even larger group of people who have almost died but never were pronounced clinically dead and never had the typical near-death experience. But when I look at how my close brushes with death affected me, I see that I have some of the same after effects that Dr. Moody described in his patients who had a classic near-death experience. In other words, having had all these close calls with death, I tend to have a deeper appreciation of life, and I also have overcome my fear of dying, and I've found in myself a shift from materialism to spirituality and an increased need to find meaning and purpose in life.
Was that a pretty dramatic shift for you?
No, not at all. I would say it was gradual. The first couple of paranormal experiences I had, I was quite young, and honestly, I didn't think anything of them. I just kind of brushed them off.
Yeah.
I just thought, well, that was weird. But I didn't tell anyone about them because I didn't think anyone would believe me. And in those days, no one talked about those experiences because there was no rational way to explain them. But then as time went on and I got more and more of these experiences, and when I went through a life-threatening illness and came out on the other side thanks to a stem cell transplant from an anonymous donor.
Oh, geez. Wow.
Yeah, that was quite dramatic. But at that point, I felt like I need to share what I've been going through because it would help other people.
The stem cell transplant, why didn't they let harvest stem cells from yourself?
Well, that's one way of doing it. But the anonymous stem cell donor, it's called an allogeneic transplant,
mm-hmm.
was more effective. They actually found someone on the worldwide computer. There's a worldwide donor bank, and they found his name on the computer, and he was a perfect match for me.
Oh, that's super. What was wrong, if you want to get into that?
Oh, sure. Well, I had leukemia.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, and I had it for many years. Well, actually, I had leukemia for 16 years, and I was in and out of the hospital. I had numerous blood transfusions, numerous courses of chemotherapy. And then finally the doctor said, we can't keep giving you chemotherapy because it's doing too much damage to your body.
Yeah. Was it still in remission?
Well, you have to be in remission in order to receive a transplant. So they gave me chemotherapy. And I was in remission, but then I would keep having relapses, and that's why eventually they gave me the transplant.
Ah.
Now, the person who gave me the transplant, he was an anonymous donor, but the rule at the time was that after 1 year, I was allowed to contact him if he agreed to be contacted.
Mm-hmm.
And I did write to him just to thank him for his generosity. And I found out that he was a member of the U.S. Navy. And when his name came up on the computer, he was stationed on an aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf.
Wow.
So he was flown back into the donor center in Washington, D.C. And then the team from the city where I live flew down to Washington and took a sample of his stem cells and then flew back to my city. And that's what happened. And that was 8 years ago, and I've been fine ever since.
Have you still been in touch with him? Did that ever happen?
Yes. I did. I actually met him in D.C., and we've kept in touch, and we've become friends.
That's amazing. He saved your life.
He did. I can't thank him enough. He did save my life. And it was sheer altruism, you know. He said the way it came about was they were having a donor drive on one of the bases where he was stationed, and he just got in line with his buddies, and all is required is a cheek swab.
That's it?
Yeah, just a cheek swab to get the DNA. So that's when his name entered the donor bank. And then years later, my name came up on the computer, and at that point, he'd even forgotten that he had agreed to be a donor. But then once, you know, we found out that he was a perfect match for me and he was flown back to the donor center in D.C., they gave him some injections to stimulate his bone marrow so he would produce more stem cells. And they gave him these injections for 5 days, and then he had produced enough stem cells, so they took a blood sample which contained the stem cells, and that was what was brought back to where I live.
That's amazing.
But yes, we've become friends, and I just saw him not too long ago.
And, Doctor, the fact that you are dabbling so heavily into the psychic realm, has that helped or hurt your psychiatric practice?
Well, I try to keep the two things separate. I mean, you know, in terms of the psychiatric patients, generally they don't talk about paranormal experiences. They have, you know, serious mental disorders that they need help with, and that's why they come to see a psychiatrist. However, since I have that experience in psychiatry, I'm able to help people distinguish between what's a psychic experience and what's a psychotic experience.
Right. And there's a big difference there.
Well, absolutely, there is a big difference. I mean, sometimes if a person sees something or hears something, they don't know what it is, they think they're losing their mind. But in fact, these types of experiences are quite common. You know, for example, if someone is bereaved, if they've lost a spouse or a child, quite often there will be some type of post-death contact with the deceased loved one. So let's say a widow might see her deceased husband in her bedroom at night, and she might talk to him, or she might feel his touch on her shoulder or something like that. And these experiences are quite common. In fact, one study showed that up to 50% of people who've lost a loved one will have some type of post-death contact with the loved one, even if a person has no belief in an afterlife, and many of them don't. I mean, these types of experiences are not related to religious beliefs or belief in an afterlife. In fact, you know, atheists and agnostics have these experiences as well as religious people.
You say that everyone is psychic, and I tend to believe you and agree with you.
Okay.
But when you say that, what's the basis for that? What makes you say that?
Well, the thing is, the word psychic covers a lot of territory. You know, it includes things such as ESP or telepathy or precognitive dreams and other things we've talked about, such as visions and voices and so on, deathbed visions, near-death experiences. So certain types of psychic experiences, such as ESP, and telepathy are extremely common, and a lot of people have experienced that type of thing. For example, someone phones you, and you were thinking about that person, then you say, oh, you must be psychic, I was just thinking about you.
Right.
So that's very common. And I think everyone has the ability, if they're interested, to nurture their intuition or their ESP or their telepathic sense. But a lot of people aren't interested in it. As I said, when I first had these experiences myself, I just kind of brushed them off. I didn't think too much of them. It was really only after I got sick that I started to think that maybe there was more to it than meets the eye.
With the psychic realm out there, and the ability to tap into it, have you found that certain people are better at it than others?
Yes, definitely. Well, I think the most important thing is whether the person is interested in it and whether or not they're paying attention to it. But the other thing I've noticed is that the psychic ability often runs in families.
Yeah, that's true.
Someone who's psychic will say, oh, my mother or my grandmother had that ability.
It seems to come more from the female side, doesn't it?
That's right. That's right, yeah. In fact, I had a great aunt who had an experience where she fell asleep and she woke up and she said her brother had died. He was living in another country. And shortly afterwards, she found out, yes, her brother.
He had died. Wow.
So, yeah. But, I mean, it does happen to men as well. And I suspect that men don't talk about it as much as women do. But, you know, people talk about a woman's intuition. So it does seem to have that connotation that it's more common in women. And I think that's probably true. Plus the fact that women are more likely to talk about it than men are.
Do you think, Doctor, these psychic experiences are from the brain or outside of the brain?
I would say both. I would say that there's a sort of cooperation between what's going on different levels or different dimensions, and these experiences are processed in the brain. So, for example, if you take the example of an out-of-body experience, which I have had myself, and it was just completely spontaneous, and I was quite young.
I had one at 11. I've never been able to duplicate it again, but it was one of the strangest, wonderful little effects I've ever had. I mean, there I was, bouncing on the ceiling, looking at my body in bed. I had stayed home from school. I never missed school, but I had a fever that day, and I didn't feel good. And my mother said, Georgie, don't go. Stay in bed. And I took a nap, and I woke up again, and this time I was looking down at myself. I thought it was a dream, Manny.
Right.
But at that point, it slammed me back into my body, and I woke up. I was jarred. I'm 11 years old. I don't know what the heck happened to me.
Yeah.
But eventually, I got my way into a library, you know, weeks later, stumbled into the psychic realm section, I guess, and found a book on astral projection, and sure enough, I said, that's what happened to me. But I've not been able to do it since then, at least in my awake moments.
Well, in my case, also, it was completely spontaneous. I wasn't trying to do it. I didn't know anything about it. I just, like you, I just found myself floating on the ceiling, looking down at my body in bed. But, you know, there are ways to produce an out-of-body experience. There was a neurologist in Montreal, Dr. Wilder Penfield, who was able to, he was mapping out the different areas of the brain, and if he put an electrical stimulation on the right temporal cortex, he was able to produce an out-of-body experience. But that doesn't tell me the out-of-body experience originates in the brain. That tells me that that area of the brain will process the out-of-body experience. And, you know, the types of out-of-body experiences we had were quite straightforward. They weren't complicated. But some people, as you say, it can be called astral projection or astral travel. People can leave not just their body, but they can leave their room, they can leave their house. You know, they can actually travel to different locations.
Absolutely. Now, do you find that the people who tend to have these kinds of experiences are believers in the paranormal or not?
I'd say no, not initially, because when this happened to me, I certainly wasn't a believer. I didn't even know such a thing was possible. And I've just kind of learned about the paranormal as I go along and as I have these experiences. Another strange experience I had when I was a student, when I was 19 years old and I was a second-year medical student, I dreamt the respirology exam the night before the exam. And when I went to the exam the next day, the first question on the exam was the same as the first question in my dream.
Ah, you had the answer then. You knew.
Exactly. So I felt like that dream helped me pass my exam. But I didn't tell anyone about it because it seemed so unbelievable. In fact, if someone had told me that story, I probably wouldn't have believed it.
The name of the book is called The Borders of Normal, with the subtitle, A Clinical Psychiatrist, you, by the way, destigmatizes paranormal phenomena. Tell me about the book.
Well, one of the reasons I wrote this book is, you know, as I say in the subtitle, I'm trying to destigmatize paranormal phenomena. Because what I found, and this is my own experience as well, when people have these experiences, they tend not to talk about them because they think people are going to think they're weird or they're strange or there's something wrong with them or they're losing their mind or something like that. But I'm trying to say that a lot of people have these experiences. It's quite normal to have these experiences. I mentioned that the word paranormal, for example, the prefix para means beside. So we have paralegals working beside lawyers, we have paramedics, Paralympics, and so on. So paranormal means beside normal. It doesn't mean abnormal. And there is still to this day a lot of stigma attached to talking about these phenomena. And I find when I give a reading or if I give a talk somewhere, people come up to me afterwards and share with me things that have happened to them, which they've never told anyone. So I'm trying to make it more acceptable for people to talk about these things. And that was really what motivated me to write the book.
Did you ever come across research from a psychiatrist who has died named Dr. Shafika Karegula?
No, I'm not familiar with him.
It's a her.
Oh, her.
And it was my aunt. And she went to Oxford University,
right?
And she got her degree in psychiatry,
yes,
and specialized in all kinds of things, and then decided she was giving all that up to study telepathy, and that's all she did. She wrote a couple books. One was called Breakthrough to Creativity, but she was convinced, totally convinced, that telepathy was the real deal. And again, a psychiatrist seeing that. And so you're the only other psychiatrist I know that has really jumped into this.
Oh, well, I'd like to look for that book that your aunt wrote. That sounds very interesting.
Yeah, Breakthrough to Creativity.
I'm definitely going to look for it. But, you know, there have been books written by physicians about near-death experiences. For example, Eben Alexander wrote Proof of Heaven.
Yep.
And he's a neurosurgeon. And Mary C. Neal, she wrote To Heaven and Back. She's an orthopedic surgeon. And, of course, Oliver Sacks, he's a neurologist. He wrote a book called Hallucinations. So physicians have written about these things, but I haven't found another psychiatrist who's written about paranormal.
Yeah, you're going to enjoy that. I mean, she just devoted her entire career to that. She passed away in a very bizarre way. She was in the bathtub, and a radio fell in there.
Oh, no.
I hope to God it wasn't listening to my show.
But, oh, no. You know, that's terrible.
It was just a horrible way.
How did she get so interested in telepathy?
She just always was. And there were some things that had happened to her, and she just decided there's something to this, and she's going to study it. And she went into it in a big way.
Well, that's good. Well, I know there's been some studies, you know, done on telepathy at Maimonides Medical Center in New York, where they were studying dream telepathy, the ability to transmit information to people who are dreaming. And in this study, they had senders and receivers, and the receivers were in a sleep lab, and they were hooked up to an EEG. So the EEG could measure what we call REM sleep, rapid eye movement. And then once the receivers were in a dream state, the senders were given random images, and they were told to concentrate on those images and try to send them to the receivers. And they found that people were more susceptible to telepathy when they're asleep. And it's also true that people are more susceptible to telepathy when they're under hypnosis. So there are ways to augment telepathy. But in my case, and in most people's cases, it just happens spontaneously.
Do you have a lot of patients that have these abilities?
No, I wouldn't say so.
All right, stay with us, Doctor. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with more Dr. Manny Matus with us, his book, The Borders of Normal. And welcome back with Dr. Manny Matus. We're talking about his work, The Borders of Normal. A clinical psychiatrist destigmatizes paranormal phenomenon. Manny, let's talk a little bit about the deathbed visions and your thoughts about that. You believe they're extremely common, don't you?
That's right. A lot of studies have shown that it's very common for someone who's dying to see a deceased friend or relative. That actually happened with my dad when he was in the hospital. He saw his late sister. He mentioned, oh, there's so-and-so. He mentioned her name. She was out in the hall.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one study that was done in a hospice with dying patients, And they found a lot of these patients said someone was coming to take them, and they didn't call them visions, they called them visitors. And as they got closer to death, these visitors became more frequent. And these visitors or these visions weren't disturbing at all. They were very comforting. So, yeah, I think those deathbed visions are very common. Now, one interesting thing about deathbed visions is that sometimes they're shared by people at the bedside. There was one case of a woman in India who was dying, and she saw someone, a deceased relative, who came to take her to the other side, and her three sisters who were at the bedside also saw the same person.
Jeez, that's unusual, though, isn't it?
It's unusual, but there's been several cases like that. There are even some cases where the medical personnel at the bedside saw the same vision that the dying patient saw. And that's interesting because, you know, people who have deathbed visions, the skeptics would say, well, that's because they're on medication or because they're confused or because they have a shortage of oxygen, there's a lack of oxygen to the brain. They try to give some kind of physical explanation for it. But if the visions are shared, then those explanations wouldn't be valid because the people at the bedside wouldn't have a shortage of oxygen to their brains, and they weren't on medication. So it's hard to know how to explain that. And there again, the people who have these visions aren't necessarily believers in the afterlife, but these experiences are quite common.
When Steve Jobs from Apple Computer died, Manny, he was quoted as saying, "Oh wow, oh wow."
Right.
Now, what do you think he was making reference to?
Well, I know some people who are dying tell their relatives they see a beautiful landscape, a beautiful vision, you know, a bright white light, you know, spiritual beings, you know, a feeling of unconditional love. You know, these are some of the things that I imagine that Steve Jobs was experiencing.
Yeah, that could be. That could be. Now, skeptics, of course, say what you've mentioned, that, you know, it's the body itself is doing all these weird things near the moment of death. How can we argue against that?
Well, there was one study of cardiac patients who had been resuscitated after a cardiac arrest. And the study was done by a cardiologist. And he said of the patients who died and were resuscitated, 18% of them had reported a near-death experience. But if that experience was due to a lack of oxygen to the brain, then they would have all had it because they all had a lack of oxygen to the brain, not just a small percentage. So, you know, that's one thing. But then the other thing is that these experiences are reported around the world, not just in the U.S., there's a lot of cross-cultural studies that show that these experiences are in many different countries and they've been reported throughout time. And one study looked at patients who were on medication versus patients who weren't on medication. And the patients who weren't on medication, who weren't confused, and who didn't have a shortage of oxygen to the brain, had the same experiences and were able to report them just as often as the other patients. So people are skeptical, I think, for a good reason, and I think it's good to be skeptical, but it's also good to keep an open mind.
Well, that's true. And you've talked about under deathbed visions that they sometimes see a little bit more than just a family member. They see other kinds of visitors as well. Explain that.
Well, the other visitors, aside from family members, they could be someone that they were very close to, or sometimes they report angels coming to the other, coming to take them to the other side. Especially with children, there was a pediatrician, Melvin Morris, who worked with dying children, and he said the dying children didn't report deceased relatives because their parents and their relatives and friends were all still living. But they reported seeing angels that were coming to take them to the other side. I had an experience at my father's funeral where I saw two angels, one on either side of the coffin.
Did anybody else see that?
No. So I could say I know they were a product of my own brain. No one else saw them. But in my own mind, I saw those angels, and they were just as clear as day standing right in front of me. And I had the idea, the thought came into my mind that they were called ministering angels. And I had the idea that they were ministering to my father to help him make the transition to the next level of the next world. And they were the most beautiful creatures. And I didn't know what to make of it. But that's really when I decided I need to start telling people about what's going on, because that was too much for me to keep to myself.
Did they see you?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
I don't think they were there for me. I think they were there for my father.
Right, so they didn't acknowledge you.
No.
Even though you saw them.
That's right. Now, the other thing is when you say in terms of deathbed visions, you know, if they were produced by certain chemicals, then why would the visitors only be people who were deceased? Why wouldn't they be other people as well? The other thing is sometimes these visions of deceased people, the person who's dying doesn't know. There may be a brother or a sister who had died. There's a case where there was a car crash, and one brother died, and the other brother was near death. So the brother that was near death had a vision of his dead brother, but he hadn't been told that his brother had died in the same accident. He didn't know that brother was dead. And there were other cases like that, too, where the deathbed visitors, the person who was dying, didn't know that that person was actually dead, but because the family wanted to spare them the knowledge.
Precognitive dreams. Give us your thoughts on what they are.
Well, there again, I've had precognitive dreams. I mentioned one about the...
They're very powerful.
Yeah, exactly. They're very powerful. And the question is, how do we know if a dream is a precognitive dream or if it's an anxiety dream? Because often, you know, when people are sleeping during their dreams, they try to process things that happen during the day or things that they're worried about. So, you know, for example, I talk about Abraham Lincoln. 2 weeks before he was assassinated, he had a dream that he was murdered. Now, we could say that that was a precognitive dream, but we could also say that could have been an anxiety dream. Maybe he was worried that someone was going to kill him.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. I think he also had a dream where he was in the White House and he walked up to a soldier who was standing by a casket.
Yes.
And it was him in the casket.
I heard of that too, yeah.
Yeah.
So that could have been a precognitive dream. But another famous person who reported a precognitive dream was Charles Dickens.
Really? I didn't hear that one.
Yeah. Because when he would put out a new book, he'd travel around the small towns and villages, and he'd give readings and so on. So one night, before he was to give a reading into a new town where he had never been before, he had a dream that a group of people came up to him after his reading, and a young woman in a red shawl introduced himself to her with four words. She said, "I am Miss Napier." So when he woke up, he thought that dream was very strange. He didn't know anyone by that name. But he remarked that the dream was very vivid, and precognitive dreams tend to be very vivid. Often when we wake up in the morning, our dreams start to fade, but precognitive dreams stay with us, and we remember every detail. So the next day, he went to give his reading, and sure enough, after the reading, a group of people came up to him, and there was a young woman wearing a red shawl, and she was introduced to him as Miss Napier. So this dream was a precognitive dream, and he didn't know what to think of it or how to explain it, but he reported he had that precognitive dream. So some people, for example, Larry Darcy is a person who's written about premonitions and precognitive dreams, and he's written about when should we pay attention to a dream, how do we know if it's a precognitive dream or not. And he said we should pay attention to dreams, first of all, if a dream is recurrent, or if it's especially vivid, or if it involves death. I heard of a case recently where this woman told her husband that she dreamt that she and her children died in a terrorist attack. And this was a number of years ago. There was I don't know if you heard of it, there was an Air India disaster where there was a terrorist attack aboard an Air India flight from Canada to Vancouver.
Yeah.
And this woman was going from Vancouver to visit her family in India, and she was going with husband and children, but then the husband decided he had some work to do in Vancouver. He stayed behind, and he was going to meet her there. And the night before that she was due to leave, she had this dream that she was see no children were killed in a terrorist attack. The husband said to her, oh, don't worry about it. It's nothing. I'm going to join you there in a couple of weeks. It'll be fine. So she got on the plane, and sure enough, that's what happened. So sometimes people have these experiences, they have these dreams, and they disregard them. You know, and I've heard of other cases like that, too. So as you say, these precognitive dreams can be very powerful. And where does this message come from? That brings up another subject, which is sometimes people receive messages in dreams which aren't precognitive.
And who's giving them the message?
That's the question, right? Where is this message coming from? You know, we can speculate. You know, we can say it's coming from the unconscious, or we could say it's coming from something they've read, or we could say it's coming from the spirit world. You know, but some of these messages, for example, this woman I mentioned who had a dream that she'd be killed in a terrorist attack, where would that be coming from? That could have been her fear,
mm-hmm.
You know, and maybe it was just a coincidence. But somehow when something like that happens, it seems to be more than a coincidence.
There was a movie about a group of people, government people, who tried to enter the dream state of other governmental leaders to assassinate them. And, you know, they wanted them to die of heart attacks, and they were going to put fear into their dreams and stuff like that. Do you think that really might be going on, Manny?
Well, that reminds me of the dream telepathy studies that I mentioned that were being conducted at Maimonides Medical Center in New York. Because I think people can be more susceptible to telepathy. I don't know, while they're dreaming, while they're asleep, I don't know, to the point of making someone have a heart attack, I don't know if that would be possible, if that's ever been done.
Well, who knows, when people die in their sleep, what caused it, right?
That's right. Because, you know, I sort of take the position that anything is possible, you know, and I think that's possible, although we don't really know, and how
right.
could we know?
That's right.
You know, so, yeah.
But that could be pretty remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was also talking about messages in dreams, because I've also had that experience where I received a message, but it wasn't a precognitive dream, it was just a message, and I didn't even know what to make of it. But I remembered it just clear as day when I woke up. This is the message I got. I just saw these words. It said, "This is a world of illusion, and the biggest illusion is time."
Didn't Caesar's wife have a premonition about the Ides of March?
That's right. In fact, she dreamt the night before he was killed, she dreamt that he was going to be assassinated. She begged him not to go to the Senate. He ignored her pleas. Also, a soothsayer told Julius Caesar, beware the Ides of March, which is the 15th of March. And he ignored the soothsayer, he ignored his wife, and he was killed. So, yeah. That was a very strong premonition. Premonition is usually a warning.
How many people don't act on their premonitions, though, Manny?
I'd say probably the majority.
I would agree.
Because I don't think people believe them. They don't believe their intuition.
And then they do the woulda, shoulda after the fact.
Yeah, exactly. And how many times has that happened? I know. That's right. The majority of people don't pay attention to it because they think, well, we live in a, you know, scientific, rational society, and we need to think of things rationally, and they disregard things which could be dismissed as superstition. There's always a fear of being labeled superstitious.
There was a movie called Let It Ride with Richard Dreyfuss. It was about horse racing, and one of his friends apparently really understood who was going to win the race, but didn't bet on that horse, bet on something else, and lost. And Dreyfuss in the movie screaming at him, going, you knew. That's a little like not acting on your premonitions.
Yeah, for sure, that is. Yeah, and you wonder why. I think it's fear. I think people
Or they don't believe it.
They don't believe it, and also they're afraid of giving into something which appears irrational.
Tell me a little bit about blind people and OBEs and things like that.
Well, that's a very interesting story, because there have been reports of blind patients who've been blind since birth who have an out-of-body experience during surgery, and then when they recover from the anesthesia and they wake up, they're able to tell the doctors and the nurses what they saw and what they heard while they were out of their bodies. There was one patient who was blind who, when he returned to his body after the surgery, was able to describe the color and the pattern on his doctor's tie. And, of course, the doctor was astounded. There was another case of a blind patient who left his body during surgery. I think no, it wasn't surgery. He had a cardiac arrest, and they took out his dentures, and he left his body, and he was observing everything that was going on. And then when he recovered, the nurse couldn't find where she put his dentures.
He wanted his teeth back, right?
Yeah, he wanted his teeth back. But then the nurse said, "I don't know where I put them." And he said, "Well, when I was out of my body, I saw you put them in that drawer over there." And she opened that drawer, and sure enough, there they were.
There they were. Wow.
Yeah.
It works.
It does work, yeah.
What have you learned, Manny, about all of this? What do you think it is?
I think that there's a spiritual component to life. I have to say that.
You do?
I do.
And you don't think it's paranormal?
Well, I think it's related. You see, I think it's paranormal, and I think it's spiritual. I mean, there's certain words that are used to describe these experiences or these phenomena. Some people call them psychic, some people call them paranormal, some people call them spiritual or anomalous, or mystical or mysterious. These are all different words that have been used to describe the same events. So I think paranormal events can have a spiritual component. Yeah, but I'm not saying every paranormal event, but some do. And of course, it depends on the person who's having the experience, how they want to interpret it or how they want to think about it.
Do you think science should do a better job investigating these things?
Oh, definitely. I think it improves the quality of life for people to feel like there is something more out there, that we don't just have to live our routine 9-to-5 day-to-day lives, that there's something more that we don't really know about. And I think it should be explored.
Up next, when we come back with Dr. Manny Matus, we're going to take phone calls, your stories about precognitive dreams, and so many other things you've heard us talk about here on Coast to Coast AM.